Hello and welcome to S&C's Critical Insights. Today we're joined by S&C M&A partner Frank Aquila, who will discuss deal-making trends in 2019. Frank will also give a forward-looking view of the 2020 M&A landscape. Frank, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Frank, how would you describe deal-making in 2019?
Deal-making in 2019 really was a bit of a tale of two cities. And what I mean by that is, if you were just doing and focusing on U.S. mega deals, this was a pretty good year. There were a lot of very large deals. The year started off, I think, January 2nd or 3rd of 2019 with the announcement of the Bristol-Myers Squibb acquisition of Celgene. And I think everybody thought this is going to be quite an amazing year, following on 2018, which was a great deal year. And then things really slowed up quite a bit. So what we saw during the course of the year was episodic deal making. What I mean by that is that there were periods where you would see three or four mega deals being announced within a few days of each other. Then you would seemingly wait a month or 6 weeks without any real significant deal activity. And then there'd be a burst of deal activity again. I think a lot of that is just fortuitous. But when you look beyond the U.S. mega deals, the deal landscape generally was a bit weak. The number of deals globally was down about 10% as compared to 2018, although 2018 was a peak year, so being a bit off of that was not that significant. I think the thing for me is not only were the mega deals happening primarily here in the United States and the Americas generally, but that the Americas, and when I say that, I mean from Canada straight through to South America, accounted for 54% of M&A deal volume. And that is quite rare and quite significant. By contrast, you saw European deal volumes go down by about a third. And the only bright spot, if you go to Asia, is Japan, where both domestic M&A in Japan and outbound M&A in Japan continues to be strong. And I think given the demographic changes in Japan, we're going to see that trend continue.
That's interesting. How has cross-border deal-making in particular been impacted by some of these trends?
So I think there's a number of trends going on here. Some of them obviously impact U.S. M&A quite a bit. But let's start in Europe, go to Asia, and then come back to the U.S. In Europe, no one really knows what Europe is going to look like. What I mean by that is we know Brexit is coming. It's going to be upon us very soon. We still don't really know exactly what post-Brexit UK is going to look like. And so therefore, as a consequence, we don't know what post-Brexit EU is going to look like. And as a consequence of that, it's difficult for companies in the EU to determine where they should be making their acquisitions. Should they be acquiring other EU companies? If they don't have a beachhead in the UK, should they be making UK acquisitions? If you're an Asian company going into Europe, do you want to be in the UK? Do you want to be in the EU? Similarly, US companies have to make that decision. I think many deals that would have happened in 2019 were frozen because everybody was waiting for Brexit to happen. First, it was going to happen at the end of March, then the end of October. Now it's been pushed into 2020. So I think once we get a clarity around what those economies look like, what those rules look like, we could see a real burst of activity in Europe, or people may wait a bit longer because clearly the European economies are not doing as well as the economy here in North America. So that may not be the best time to do transactions. That, I think, is the biggest issue in the EU and in Europe generally. In Asia, you have two different forces pulling and pushing M&A. Obviously, while Asia is many, many different economies, and most of them are very vibrant, the two economies that really drive M&A activity are China and Japan. Let's look at China first. There's the trade war with the U.S. It looks like that is getting resolved and that the tariffs are going to be less of an issue. But given the recent volatility, companies both in China looking outward and companies outside of China looking inward have to question whether they're making bets that are going to pay off within a reasonable period of time, whether these are truly the right long-term investments to be making, whether you, if you're going to Asia, do you want to be in China? Do you want to be near China? Do you want to be looking towards the Chinese domestic market, the China export market? So there's a lot of questions that are still unanswered. The other thing is that given some of the issues within the Chinese economy, which is still growing quite a bit, but not growing at the rate that it was for the prior 20 years, there is some attempt within China, very heavy attempt within China, to keep capital within the country. And that means that as a result of that, there's less outbound M&A activity. And while you'd say that's not really that much of a factor in the U.S. and even in Europe, because there are impediments to acquisition by Chinese company, particularly by state-owned enterprises. But the reality is that a lot of the acquisitions that the Chinese entities make are in smaller Asian countries, in Africa and elsewhere. So the outbound slowing of Chinese M&A has had a profound impact, I think, on M&A in a lot of areas around the world. Japan is a different story. Japan, as we all know, is a society that is aging. It's a society that is starting to shrink in size. The demographics show that it will be much smaller in 30 years than it is today. Nevertheless, it has very large multinational companies that have tremendous resources, that have the ability to borrow at effectively, when you factor in inflation, at no cost. And they have a strong rationale to continue to grow and be profitable because many Japanese citizens own shares, and that in many ways is what is going to support them through their old age. So as a consequence, the government and businesses in Japan recognize that they need to consolidate at home with a shrinking workforce, number one, and number two, to create more value. And then they need to expand into other places. Southeast Asia is one of them, so that they have a workforce, and to places like the United States and Western Europe, so that they have markets and access to markets that will bring them greater income and growth opportunities in the future. In the U.S., we're obviously affected by the trends I was talking about in Europe and in Asia. I think we're also affected clearly by the political climate. And many of the deals that were announced in 2019, some of which were still pending, some of which were announced early in the year, took close to a year to get through the regulatory review and process. I think at the start of the Trump administration, there was a hope that it would very much be a Reagan-esque type of antitrust review. And I think what we found is rather than being a classical Republican approach to regulatory review, antitrust review particularly, that it's a much more populist approach to regulatory review. And while deals still get done, and I think the track record has been pretty strong in terms of transactions being approved, they're not being approved quickly, and divestitures and other things are being required. That has been a bit of a drag on transactions getting done. Those are the factors that I think are weighing on deals, particularly cross-border deals. The other thing I would say with respect to cross-border deals generally, and this is a factor we've been dealing with for a number of years now, and that is that as governments become more populist, and you know, this is whether you know you're dealing with Xi in China, a Johnson in the UK, Donald Trump here in the United States, that global trade, global economic viewpoints are less important. And each of them are catering and focused on their own domestic constituencies and short-term goals as opposed to longer-term macroeconomic trends that might be in the long term better for their economies and better for the global economies. And that's just something that we've had to deal with and I think we'll have to deal with for some time now.
Frank, what industries had a noteworthy year in M&A?
Well, I think there are a number. Healthcare seems to be a industry that no matter what, every year we talk about how healthcare M&A is strong. I think even in early 2009, right after, I guess, right in the midst of the financial crisis, when it was hard to borrow money to buy a car, even if you had stellar credit ratings, we saw in the first quarter of 2009, two mega pharmaceutical deals, both over $50 billion. And that was a year when very few transactions were done. This year, of course, was no different. AbbVie agreed to acquire Allergan. I mentioned Bristol-Myers Squibb and Celgene. Our client Novartis recently agreed to acquire The Medicines Company. Our client Amgen agreed to acquire Otezla. And many other and smaller deals that were done. The deals in healthcare are significant financially. They all have very large price tags on them, but they're also very important strategically. Of any industry, you really have seen the globalization of this industry because, let's face it, if someone has heart disease, if someone has cancer, if someone has psoriatic arthritis, it's the very same disease whether you're living in Africa, North America, China. And the treatments are the same across all geographies. It doesn't make sense for someone in each country to recreate these different treatments. So healthcare is much more a global industry than almost any other industry out there. And so we're seeing a lot of globalization. Our client Takeda, not this year, but the year before, acquired Shire. Astellas did a major transaction this year. Both of those are Japanese pharmaceutical companies. Our client Novartis, as I mentioned, is a Swiss pharmaceutical company. Amgen is a U.S. biologics company. That's something that you're seeing. Novartis, which has traditionally been more of a pharmacy company, acquired The Medicines Company, which is a biologics company. Amgen, on the flip side, the world's largest biologics company, acquired Otezla, which is a pharmaceutical, their first pharmaceutical acquisition. Very interesting deals. I think in the financial services sector, we saw a rebirth of M&A activity. Started off with the SunTrust BB&T deal. We thought that we were going to see a lot more. I think we have seen more this year than we've seen previously, and I think we will see more. The other sector that I would point to, which has been a bit of a surprise, has been the long-awaited consolidation in luxury. And retail generally and consumer goods have been hard hit. Luxury has been the area that has been, I was going to say the silver lining, let's call it the gold or the platinum lining within the retail and consumer goods area. Two of our clients were acquired this year, I think were the bellwether deals in luxury. First was Sotheby's by Patrick Drahi. That deal closed in September. Then our client Tiffany was approached in October by LVMH with an unsolicited proposal. That deal signed up in late Thanksgiving and hopefully will close sometime in the first half of 2020. But these are very significant deals in the luxury sector. As I said, this is a consolidation that has been expected for a long period of time. And I think we're going to clearly see a lot more. Obviously, technology is a sector that continuously grows and combines, because what's new technology today is old technology tomorrow, and the old technology companies need to acquire the new technology companies. So that's always going to be there. And that's something we saw this year, and we'll see next year, and we'll see in 5 years.
Thank you. Could you talk about how corporate governance and activism trends have shaped the M&A landscape?
Corporate governance has really been shaping M&A activity for the last 20 years or so, really since the dot-com bubble burst in the early 2000s. And the reality is that if you go back to the 1950s, 95% of public company shares were held by individuals, and only about 5% were held by institutional shareholders. And they were essentially pension funds, which were rather passive. Today, it's reversed. Only about 5% of public company shares are held by individuals, and 95% are held by institutions. And as a consequence of that, the institutional shareholder base, which, and institutions are very different. They can be hedge funds, some of whom are activists, some of whom are passive. They can be ETFs and tracking stocks, which are very passive. They can be the Fidelities and T. Rowe Prices of the world. They can be active managers. They can be pension funds. Some pension funds, like the Teamsters pension funds, are obviously more political than others. So we talk about institutional investors, but they are very, very different among themselves. So they are very much influencing what boards do and how business operates. ISS and Glass Lewis, which are the proxy advisory firms, they really reflect the views of the institutional investor community. And even without ISS and Glass Lewis, many of the large institutional shareholders have their own in-house governance arms that look at many of these same issues. This is really an important part of it. Two trends that I'll mention. One is that the Business Roundtable came out with a statement on the purpose of a corporation, which talked about going beyond just creation of shareholder value. I really look at that and say a good corporation should be looking at all of those different factors as a way to create shareholder value, because if you're relevant to your other constituencies, you're going to create shareholder value. In the end, though, when you go to sell the company, I think it doesn't really fundamentally change the fiduciary duties that boards of directors have to get the highest value for their shareholders. But I think it's a very important step that the Business Roundtable took. And I think it's a very important discussion that we're having with our clients at the board level. The other thing that I think we're seeing is many boards are now focused on board diversity. There's gender diversity, of course, but there's diversity beyond gender. And I think that's a very good thing. I think as a white male, an old white male, I can say this, that boardrooms that have nothing but old white men like me see from a particular perspective. And while I think my perspective on the world and on business is the right perspective, I do recognize that there are a lot of other perspectives out there, and having more diversity in the boardroom, age, gender, race, whatever, is important. And I think a focus on that is a very, very good thing.
So, Frank, in conclusion, what does deal making look like into 2020?
Well, in a perfect world, we would do double the volume we did in 2018. We would have a robust cross-border M&A activity, and we'd have no trade tensions, populism would go away, and regulatory oversight would be minimal. The reality is we know that none of that is really going to happen. However, I think there are a lot of bright signs ahead. What I mean by that is there clearly is a tremendous pent-up demand for significant M&A activity. Companies in Europe, Japan, the United States, and even to a large extent in places like China, are in relatively slow growth economies. And when you're in a slow growth economy, you need growth in one way or another. And if you're not going to get it organically from the economy itself growing, you need to get it inorganically. And the best way to get that is to do a significant acquisition where there's going to be synergy savings right off the top, hopefully growing into new markets, hopefully expanding with respect to new product offerings and new people, new blood within the company. And so I think there's that pent-up demand. So that's number one. Number two, I do think that the trade wars of 18 and 19, which, you know, haven't gone away by any means, but hopefully have dissipated a bit, will allow deals to go forward that haven't been. The elections in the U.S. will hopefully be an impetus for U.S. deals getting done, simply because people won't know what a Democratic administration might mean. If the Democrats win, if Trump wins a second term, people won't know. So the uncertainty of what comes in 21 and beyond from a regulatory standpoint means that there'll be a lot of drive to get things done today rather than waiting to see what comes beyond. I think in Europe, for better or worse, whatever comes out of Brexit, we're going to finally get some clarity there. I think that will allow European companies to do more. I think it will allow non-European companies to make decisions about where they want to go with respect to acquisitions, whether they be in the UK, they be in the rest of Europe, and vice versa for European companies. So I think there's a lot of bright spots that we can look towards. Interest rates are going to remain very low. That's going to be very positive. I think stock market valuations will remain relatively high where they are today, but probably not move up too much so that they're not making companies prohibitively costly. And so we might be in sort of a nice sweet spot where the global economy is okay, but not growing robustly, but growing at a pace that makes people say, okay, now's the time to, I've cleaned up my balance sheet, I've cut as much as I can, I've become very efficient, but now's the time I really need to go and do something. And so 2020 has the prospect of being a very good year for M&A. We'll talk in 6 months and see where we are in the mid-year, but it looks like it could be a very, very active and strong M&A market in 2020, and we're just all crossing our fingers and hoping that that's the case.
Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.